Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The Oscar-nominated documentary about the life of James Baldwin, I Am Not Your Negro, is a film ostensibly inspired by Baldwin's uncompleted book, Remember This House, a project on the lives and assassinations of Medgar Evers, Malcolm X, and Martin Luther King Jr. But in the hands of filmmaker Raoul Peck, the film has become a story about Baldwin's work for racial justice and a larger story about race relations in the United States, both past and present. Here's a clip of Baldwin speaking at the Cambridge Union from the film.
It is a terrible thing for an entire people to surrender to the notion that 1/9 of its population is beneath them. And until that moment, until the moment comes when we, the Americans, we, the American people, are able to accept the fact that I have to accept, for example, that my ancestors are both white and black, that on that continent we are trying to forge a new identity for which we need each other, and that I am not a ward of America. I am not an object of missionary charity. I am one of the people who built the country. Until this moment, there is scarcely any hope for the American dream, because the people who are denied participation in it, by their very presence, will wreck it. And if that happens, it's a very grave moment for the West. Thank you.
That's a clip from the new documentary, I Am Not Your Negro, the film which has been nearly universally hailed by critics and is among the top grossing documentaries of the year, has been the subject of vote brigading, an orchestrated campaign to drive up the negative scores for online movie rankings. But in other places, the film has been a starting point for frank discussions on race today. I'm joined today by Hannibal Johnson, a writer, attorney, and consultant, and Bob Jackson, an associate professor of English at the University of Tulsa, who specializes in teaching about the writings of James Baldwin. They'll be hosting a panel discussion at the Circle Cinema on the first day of showings of the documentary. They'll be speaking Friday evening at 7, and they join me today to talk about the issues and themes raised in the film. Bob and Hannibal, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Great to see you.
Yeah, good to see you. You'll be speaking for the opening of this film, I Am Not Your Negro, by Raoul Peck, which takes the writings and filmed versions of James Baldwin, a major figure in the civil rights movement. As important for what he actually said, it was his witnessing. And this project, this film project, came out of a book project that never came to be on the deaths of three major figures in the 1960s, Medgar Evers, Malcolm X, and Martin Luther King. But what's really amazing is you're talking about a man who's speaking about the 60s. What you hear is things that apply to us just as much in 2017.
Right. So James Baldwin was not just a powerful voice, he was a prophetic voice. And the things that he said and the things that he did during the height of the civil rights movement in the 60s are highly relevant today. One of the quotes from James Baldwin that I really like is the following. I love America more than any other country in this world, and exactly for this reason, I insist on the right to criticize her perpetually. That criticism, I think, is really important if we're really intent on dismantling systemic racism. The film is not about James Baldwin. The film is about race in America and how systemic it is and how we are still really retrotting the same ground that we covered before, and that these issues never seem to fully abate. They may retreat temporarily, but they never fully abate, which is really testimony to how deeply embedded and ensconced they are.
Baldwin was writing and bearing witness during a period when public intellectuals felt a great deal of commitment to these social issues. And he had been thinking about race all his life. He grew up in Harlem, basically a street kid from a very poor family that was moving all over the place because they were getting evicted and sort of pushed around by the economic structure that they were part of. And he just grew up with this very sensitive perception of race in the United States. So that by the time he was even in his early 20s, he had had so much exposure to racial issues that he really couldn't even deal with the United States anymore. He went to France in 1948, really kind of on the front edge of the civil rights era. and spent a decade there, but eventually came back to the United States, partly out of a desire to participate, not so much as an activist, you know, of the sort that we associate with someone like Martin Luther King or with all those millions of people putting their bodies on the line, you know, in sit-ins and protests and trying to integrate deeply segregated parts of the United States, but simply by asking penetrating questions about race. As Hannibal's saying, the compulsion to be a critic was emerging from the depth of his commitment to the idea of America. He really loved the United States.
In addition to being a critic, he was a witness, too, because he was witnessing a lot of these events, too, sure. And writing about them.
Well, you know, I would say that Baldwin was essentially a black everyman, because the way he experienced race was no different from the way that my father, who was a contemporary, experienced race. And it left really deep scars on my father, because he fought, for example, in World War II, was treated much more like a human being in France than he ever was in rural Arkansas, where he grew up. Mm-hmm. And so Baldwin intellectually was able to use the right words to communicate with white intellectuals about what this dynamic of race did to real people in real time.
I was struck by something you said a moment ago, that these issues surrounding race never go away. They abate, and then they show up again. My feeling is what the civil rights era did was maybe abate some of the worst aspects of racism, but this whole other layer that we are dealing with today has been with us since prior to the 1960s, through the 1960s, through the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and right up to today. I mean, the issues of how police treat African Americans, how people really feel in their hearts. There was a very strong quote by Baldwin at the end of the film in which he says, whites created, he uses the N-word, he says, whites created this. And says, really, he said, whites have to examine why they needed to create this. And that's really at the heart of it, isn't it?
And when you say that, I think about the psychological phenomenon of projection. So the Negro, or the N-word, is the object of projected failings, failures, fears of the dominant culture. And in terms of, you talked about the heart, the heart is really important. Another Baldwin quote that I took note of in the film, he said, "I am terrified of the moral apathy, the death of the heart that is happening in my country." I think we could say that now.
Yeah. And I think that's the really interesting thing about James Baldwin, is when you listen to these quotes, when you read his writings, he's talking as much about today as he was about 1965, 68, 1970 when he was writing these words.
Yeah, it's amazing to go back. I've taught Baldwin's works in the classroom at TU for a while now, years, and they never go out of date. They really never seem irrelevant or, you know, I mean, it's a, you know, you can always teach Shakespeare 500 years old and it still speaks to you, even though those political issues are out of date. But there's something about Baldwin that seems to be urgent. There's a kind of urgency that reminds us that the period in the 50s and the 60s that he was writing about, in which things were really at a critical impasse in terms of race in this country, have not changed in really fundamental ways, particularly economically, I think. You know, a lot of Baldwin's stuff is sort of about the struggle for mental health. You know, just what do I have to do to get through the day sane? What do I have to do to be able to love myself and to love other people in a really basic way? But also at the heart of his criticism is this idea that racism is profitable and that structural inequality is so fundamental to the American dream, really, to the American system, that even when people think that they have excised racism from their hearts, there's still this kind of compulsive pattern that we rely on that creates very racist results. And it's really difficult to get past that until we've faced some of the fundamental problems in this society.
One of the things this film does is really shows that through media that goes back to the earliest parts of the 20th century, but films from virtually every era, there are clips that sort of reinforce his words, really.
Can I plug my book here?
Sure.
Okay. Well, it's coming out in a couple of months, and I've written a book that it basically is a history of film about the southern United States, and it's going to be called Fade in Crossroads, A History of the Southern Cinema. And it basically is a compendium of these images of race as it exists in the first half of the 20th century. So you get movies about the Civil War, you get movies about life back on the plantation, displaying what a wonderful place it was back in the old days. The slaves were happy and content, and it's really just kind of this remarkable catalog of film history that goes into the entire history of Hollywood. I mean, this is kind of the history of American media. So we wonder why it's so difficult to get past some of these stereotypes. Well, they built the system, and they're still there in a lot of basic ways.
Hannibal, in your own work, you work a lot of breaking through these stereotypes. How pervasive are they?
Quite. You know, the language these days, we talk about implicit bias, particularly as regards the law enforcement situation and law enforcement departments interacting with communities of color, and we talk about implicit bias. But implicit bias really has its foundation in stereotypes. We all have some sort of implicit biases. And when I talk to law enforcement, what I say to them is, look, implicit bias is universal, but it's much more consequential in the context in which you work, right? If you're in law enforcement, you have the power and authority to take somebody's life. So you have to get in touch with those biases. You have to think about where they come from. They come from media. They come from families. They come from religion. They come from all manner of places. And we have to be aware and we have to engage with one another and talk about these things. The one thing I think is really important to say about James Baldwin, he really didn't engage in ad hominem type attacks against white people. He was attacking the system and not the people, which is really important because it transcends the sort of lower level conversations that we have that can lead to personal conflict. If we focus on the system and the dynamics within the system, then it's much more likely that we'll be able to come together and work towards some better place for all of us.
My guests today are Hannibal Johnson, writer, attorney, and consultant, and Bob Jackson, an associate professor of English who specializes in James Baldwin. He's at the University of Tulsa. They'll be featured speakers at the Circle Cinema Friday evening at 7 for the opening of I Am Not Your Negro by Raoul Peck, which is up for an Oscar. It opens this weekend at the Circle Cinema. And hopefully to have an important discussion on race, not only in our country, but also in Tulsa Friday night.
Yeah, I hope that there's a nice crowd. I hope that people are interested in the film. It's not your usual Hollywood fare that is simply just escapist entertainment. But it's really a remarkable film that I hope will reach a wide audience beyond people who consider themselves down with the cause in one way or another. It's really a film about U.S. history. As I was watching the film, and I grew up in a very suburban, middle-class background in the St. Louis area up in Missouri, I was thinking about my family members. I was thinking about my extended family and my parents who were not particularly interested in, I mean, of course, they were caught up in the civil rights era, but they weren't activists in any real way. And it's really a story about American history since World War II. It's about this period of affluence in the 50s and 60s in which people were sorting out their views of race in sometimes violent ways and sometimes very peaceful and constructive and loving ways. But I'd love to see an audience for this film of ordinary people who are just ingenuously open-minded about the problems that continue to exist in the society and also many of the great possibilities. It's a constructive film. I think it's a film that invites us to think in open-minded ways about some of the great resources that we have as Americans, including our great tradition of criticism, great tradition of sharing ideas and protest as something that embraces the fullness of what it means to be an American.
Yeah.
For decades, race has been framed as the Negro problem. And the film really reframes it as the American problem. And Baldwin says,
that's right,
Black history is American history, and it's not a pretty story. So we're in Black History Month. This February is Black History Month. And I've always advocated that the sooner that we can get rid of Black History Month, the better off we are. But that can only happen to the extent that we incorporate and integrate, as it should be, Black history into the American history curriculum. That's part of our problem, as I see it.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And it's not just a curriculum. It's an understanding that race pervades everything that we do in this civilization. It always has, and it probably always will. And that's not a bad thing because it's a multi-ethnic civilization. We have traditions from around the world for 400 years that contribute to American culture. So it's really a question of trying to understand these things as assets and getting the most out of them to create new opportunities for the future.
You know, one of the interesting things about the film, it does take this historical approach, but what's really interesting is as you're seeing very powerful historical imagery and you're hearing Baldwin's words, all of a sudden you move forward 40 years mm-hmm. to Ferguson or to other places where you're seeing police and African-Americans violently confronting each other over you know, confrontations between police and groups of African-Americans. I thought that was really effective in the film because it reminds you that these problems are still there, and what he's saying applies equally to the images of today as the past.
These are fundamentally human problems, and part of what we need to move toward is understanding our shared humanity, and I think that's part of the big message of the film. It's about that shared humanity, because when you can otherize people and when you can diminish them and think of them as less than human, then it's easy for all these negative behaviors to proliferate.
One of the things I found really interesting about this film, James Baldwin was quoting Robert F. Kennedy probably right around 1968 when he was making his presidential bid.
I remember, for example, when the ex-attorney general, Mr. Robert Kennedy, said that it was conceivable that in 40 years in America we might have a Negro president. And that sounded like a very emancipated statement, I suppose, to white people. They were not in Harlem when this statement was first heard, and did not hear, and possibly will never hear, the laughter and the bitterness and the scorn which the statement was greeted. From the point of view of the man in the Harlem barbershop, Bobby Kennedy only got here yesterday. And now he's already on his way to the presidency. We've been here for 400 years, and now he tells us that maybe in 40 years, if you're good, we may let you become president.
It did take exactly 40 years.
That's right. I think the frustration that Baldwin was feeling at that moment was a result of, first of all, his history with Robert F. Kennedy, and he'd always found them to be, both of the Kennedy brothers, pretty intransigent. You know, John F. Kennedy's remembered as a fairly progressive civil rights president, but it really wasn't until the last few months of his life before he started to get in gear. For the first couple of years, he was really dragging his feet on a lot of those things. And when Kennedy said this in 68, he basically was saying, if you can just imagine that an African-American might be elected president someday, it'll calm you down so that you won't be out in the streets so much, you won't be protesting so much. It basically was a way of trying to get political consensus around the idea of race rather than having people agitate for any sort of change from below. So it was kind of a patronizing statement in that respect.
But you know, that's not unlike what has been done in some circles with religion, which often told African Americans, wait until the afterlife. So you be patient with the system as it exists here on earth. Your reward is in the afterlife.
That's right. And, you know, the Baldwin's understanding of time is really a major theme throughout his life. William Faulkner, the great writer from Mississippi, in 1956 made some comments that basically said, okay, black people have gotten great progress in these last couple of years, the Montgomery bus boycott and the Brown v. Board case, right? So now it's time to go slow. And this just absolutely infuriated a number of black leaders, but Baldwin among them. And Baldwin wrote a piece in response and talked about this very thing that Hannibal is bringing up here, this idea that black people have been sold this bill of goods. Protest is not necessary because there will be some kind of improvement way down the line, right? Just deal with what you have in front of you right now because your reward will come later, whether that's in heaven or some imaginary political change that might come along later on. And Baldwin's argument was that that's actually not true. The time is always now.
Yeah. Now, and if we can extrapolate here now 40 years later, I think one of the things that has fueled this reexamination is the idea in some circles that with an election of a black president, everything's equal. The day of Jubilee has come, as some commentators have said about some Supreme Court decisions about the Voting Rights Act, that we are equal. And these are still issues we're still working through.
Yeah, I think we have to look if we're looking at equality or equity, we have to look at the state of the masses, not at this sort of exception, this super qualified exception, by the way, in terms of people who've been president. And I would argue that he could not have become president had he not been hyper qualified. But if we look at the disparities that exist in education, in housing, in employment, in opportunity generally, how much has really changed? I mean, black men are still have an unemployment rate that's roughly twice that of white men. Educational disparities are still large.
A couple
of studies have been done recently that caught my eye. One was that black boys are perceived to be 4 or 5 years older than they really are and therefore more dangerous and less entitled to the presumption of youthful innocence, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that black men generally are perceived as menacing and threatening. So those kinds of deeply embedded biases on the part of large swaths of society don't spell good things for the black community. Yeah. And race relations.
And the other thing I'd say in addition to that, and really didn't even mention the prison system, which was a huge part of this thing. Time keeps going by, and there is no end point. There is no touchdown that wins the game in history or in politics. Great things that may have happened in the past, whether it's the civil rights achievements of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 or the election of Barack Obama in 2008, as remarkable and extraordinary as those things are, they are only individual events. And then we all wake up the next day and make things happen in the world. So what we've seen in the U.S., and this is a several hundred-year-old pattern, is that every achievement, every progressive advancement is answered by a backlash. There is always going to be a movement of people that simply is furious about progressive change. And I mean furious. I mean, we've seen the kind of intransigence that has accompanied this recent period of history. So race is kind of low on the list in this way. I mean, it's only a factor in this larger story about corporate culture and religion and global affairs. I mean, there's a lot of pieces to the puzzle here, and race relations, domestic race relations are part of that. But, you know, it's important to keep that in mind. As extraordinary as President Obama's example has been, that we have also seen simultaneous to it an intense backlash that continues to be a very influential part of American history.
I think one of the other things that's important to point out is that race relations is often viewed as a zero-sum game. So to the extent that somebody takes a step forward or makes progress, somebody's losing something. Somebody's giving up some power and privilege
That's the perception.
Right. At least that's a perception. And so if we continue to view it that way, it becomes, you know, increasingly difficult to make real sustainable progress.
When in fact, all of the research demonstrates that diversity makes everybody richer economically. It makes everybody smarter. You know, the more diverse my classroom is, the better results I get from my students. Straight up, it happens every time. And you can measure this all the way down to early childhood education and all the way through the PhD program in English at the University of Tulsa. That's just the way it's always been. And there are reams of research on this. This is really one of the areas that I think is the most ripe for revision, that ordinary people can think about diversity and racial progress in this country in better ways by imagining it as something that everyone will benefit by.
Bob Jackson is an associate professor of English at the University of Tulsa. Hannibal Johnson, a writer, attorney, and consultant. They'll be speaking as a part of the opening of I Am Not Your Negro, a new film by Raoul Peck, which opens this weekend at the Circle Cinema. They'll be speaking Friday evening at 7 at the Circle Cinema. And Hannibal, I know you brought some quotes in, and I'll offer you as well a chance to sort of talk about the words of Baldwin that really speaks to you most.
Well, I just happen to have some quotes handy, as you pointed out. Not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it is faced.
Yeah.
Your crown has been bought and paid for. All you must do is put it on, which I love.
And Bob, you're teaching a class again on Baldwin. What speaks to you most?
Well, you know, as Hannibal's talking about Baldwin's kind of more gentlemanly approach to this conundrum of race, he was never a race baiter. He was never somebody who would point the finger at individuals, even when taking on individuals like Faulkner or Robert F. Kennedy or any of the people that he disagreed with. It was always on a very high plane of respect and intellectual discourse, but it was also structural. He understood that he was writing about the state of an entire civilization. So when he could attack business or religion or something like that, he was doing so with the whole system in mind. And there's a quote that I have gone back to a number of times recently. And this is about his attitudes about Christianity. And he actually had been a preacher as a teenager. His stepfather was a preacher, and he was really drawn into Christianity as a young man. And then essentially walked away from the church because he believed that there was too much corruption and hypocrisy there. And he said, whoever wishes to become a truly moral human being must first divorce himself from all the prohibitions, crimes, and hypocrisies of the Christian church. And this is something that's really come back to me recently, because there are a lot of people out there with very devout religious faith who are genuinely torn about where we are in terms of race in this country. And I think it's a valuable thing to remember that Baldwin is really trying to push people to a greater moral identity and a greater sense of themselves as true Christians. The reason to be nonviolent, the reason to have a Christian approach to racial progress in this country, is because it will uplift your opponent and humanize both of you in the process. Violence is only going to bring everybody down.
All right. Well, the film opens Friday, and I guess you'll be taking questions as well as talking about the film Friday night. Gentlemen, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us, Rich.
Hannibal Johnson and Bob Jackson speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. They'll be hosting a panel discussion this Friday evening at 7 at the Circle Cinema upon the opening of the new film by Raoul Peck, I Am Not Your Negro. Visit circlecinema.com for showtime information. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.